Every community has a place where people meet and stories are told. The East Coast has stoops, the South has porches, and in Alaska, we have Arctic entries.
Here, Alaskans share their personal stories, funny, sad, and sweet. These stories are originally told at our monthly event in Anchorage. At each live performance, seven people tell a seven-minute-long, true story related to the show's theme.
I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards.
Welcome to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. This hour of Arctic Entries is based on the theme, I Got This. We've curated stories of persistence, insistence, and grabbing the bull by the horns.
All these stories were originally told in front of a live theater audience at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts in Anchorage. We'll hear from longtime Alaskans like Hans Arnett.
And I go up on stage, and as I'm being introduced, I look out on this sea of women. 335 Anchorage women, and every single one of them is dressed to kill. It's an amazing sight. And the music starts, and I begin to dance.
You'll hear more of that story later, but to start off our show, here's music from local band SJ and Drums.
This wrecking ball has fallen for ya, destroying walls and making mountains crumble. So what's at stake? I burn down all the mansions. I'm lying here with love built from the ashes. The woods grow tall until I bring the axes. I'll clear them all just to give you passage, and then you'll see the mountains in the distance. That's where I'll be. You'll hear me. I'll say run. because in your arms is where I belong. I'll say run, your path is clear. I'll say run, you'll find me here. I'll say run, fast and strong, because in your arms is where I belong. Because in your arms is where I belong. Because in your arms is where I belong. Thank you.
That was SGN Drums, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour. The duo was recorded as part of our January 2014 live show.
Our first story on this show is told by Deborah Nelson, who says that when she was young, she was way less smarter than she is now.
I think she said significantly less smart.
Either way, in this story, she made some bad decisions. Here's Deborah Nelson live at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts.
So when I was 19, I dropped out of college because I thought I'd like to try my career development opportunities as a laborer on a horse ranch in Arizona. So I loaded up everything that I owned in my little two-wheel drive, low-riding, long extended cab Ford Ranger pickup that I had inherited from my father. And this Ford pickup was pimped out redneck style. If you can imagine it, it had a large metal grill in the front, similar to what you'd see on the front of a police cruiser, which I could only imagine is for hitting things or running things over and not causing damage to your own vehicle. That's my dad. It also had a big, tall antenna whipping in the wind, you know, country songs can cue now, and it had big, huge floodlights, but they were facing the wrong direction. They were going backwards, and there was a little switch right by my steering wheel, because my dad was also an and he would blind anyone who tailgated him. So I drove this truck to Arizona, and to this little Alaskan girl, Arizona was like another planet. There was cactus everywhere. Is it cactus or cacti? I don't know. There were javelinas. There was a Gila monster in my yard. There was, you couldn't see your hand in front of your face. It was so dark. There were scorpions in my shower. And there were people running from the nearby Mexican border with bales of marijuana on their back asking, Aravaca? And you'd point and say, that way, good luck. Because this ranch was really in the middle of nowhere. If you drove an hour that direction, you'd get to Mexico. And if you drove about 2 hours that direction, you'd get to Tucson. But thankfully, only 30 minutes that direction, you'd get to Aravaca. And I say thankfully because we only had one day off a week, and so you want your watering hole to be really close. So Aravaca, this little one-horse town with a 150-year-old bar and a 150-year-old bartender, he was a giant biker with a big white beard named Tiny, and he never once checked my fake ID. God bless him. So Aravaca became our stomping grounds. And since I was one of the few people with a vehicle all to myself, we would take my truck when we went. And it was on one of these cultural excursions to Aravaca that I had my first run-in with the Border Patrol. And that totally freaked me out because nobody has ever done that to me in Alaska, but suddenly out of nowhere, driving through the desert at night, you can't see in front of your own headlights, and what you do see are shadows that are very menacing and don't seem nice at all, and are monsters probably. But then suddenly out of nowhere, because we hadn't seen any lights or any other vehicles or humans, for the last 30 minutes, this giant vehicle comes right up behind me and it has big bright lights. And my friend says, oh, don't worry about it, that's just the Border Patrol, they're always out and about, and it's, you know, at nighttime especially, so just slow down, they're probably going to just want to check out your license plate and they'll talk to you. Well, slow down, screw that. Because if there's one thing that my father, who is also an eccentric Vietnam veteran, has ever taught me is fight the man, you know. So you know what, they haven't announced themselves. I don't know that they're an agent of the U.S. government, and they don't have their lights on, I haven't seen a badge, so I floor it. And I go, I think, let's see how far we get, and let's see what happens here, you know. So as you can as you can imagine, eventually, you know, they stop, and they come to the to my driver's side and passenger side with semi-automatic weapons and very large flashlights, and I say, it's okay, officer, I'm white. And And we have a nice long conversation about, you know, what it's like growing up in Alaska and what am I doing in Arizona and why am I driving so quickly and why on earth, oh, did I blind them with my headlights? Because I flipped that little switch being the daughter of an asshole and I blinded them before I hit the gas. Forgot to mention that. So, and I said, well, hey, I didn't know who you were. Nobody in Alaska treats me that way, so I didn't know who you were, and I haven't seen anybody, and you could have been dangerous. And, you know, they said, okay, well, no illegal activities have been done here. And mind you, this is before 9/11, so if the Border Patrol really had a lot of power, none of us really knew about it. They were kind of a joke. They couldn't do anything. And if you weren't an illegal immigrant or actively doing something that had to do with the border, it was just like a ha-ha, thank you, see you later. So they said, please don't do this again, slow down, you know, be respectful, don't get hurt, blah, blah, blah. And I said, slow down. Well, I didn't say this to them. But this game was way too fun to just do one time. So this turned into a game that I like to call the Border Patrol. So it turned into a regular occurrence on our excursions to Aravaco or the nearby communities. And it, you know, different nuances at different times and how fast or how far you got before they finally announced themselves. And they were always irritated and I was always laughing. And it just, you know, that's how it went. And then one day we decided that we were going to go to Tucson instead of Aravaca. And I used my fake ID from one end of that town to the other and it was a great night. And the next day, despite a headache and, you know, a queasy stomach, I was really enjoying the weather as I drove back home to the ranch. You know, it's gorgeous springtime in Arizona is not springtime in Alaska. The clouds weren't there. It was bluebird. It was warm. You know, the sun is shining. I've got the windows down. It's going through the truck, and I've got nothing but a straight road in front of me, and I've got nothing ahead of me but the ranch. So I take off my button-up shirt, and I'm getting some sun. I'm wearing a little camisole. I've got the radio on. I'm listening to the Crocodile Rock. I'm singing. I'm cruising along, and oh, I see a pullout. There's some official-looking vehicles. So I slow down because I'm in no mood to play. I'm hungover. The Border Patrol wins today. So I go to pass them, and then I resume my speed, which I think is a reasonable level, and I later find out was about 90 or 100 miles an hour. And I continue on about 20 or 30 miles down the road, rocking out to the Crocodile Rock, you know. And then I turn off on my driveway to the ranch, and that's when I see, in my rearview mirror, I see a lot of lights. And I see multiple vehicles, a lot of vehicles. And this is when I realize that this isn't the Border Patrol. This is the Arizona State Troopers. And there's a whole, you can imagine, you know, turn the vehicle off, drop your keys out the window, put your hands behind your back. I end up handcuffed in my little camisole, dragged backwards. I'm, you know, dogs are being sent up to the vehicle and they're talking on the radios about backup. There's a helicopter being mentioned. You know, why were you trying to make a run for the border? I wasn't. You know, why didn't you stop when you heard our sirens? You know, I was doing the Crocodile Rock. You know, and why didn't you stop when you saw our lights? You know, the sun was in my eyes. And so, you know, 20 minutes later after they, you know, called Alaska to verify my plates and confiscated my fake ID and called the ranch to make sure that I actually worked there. And they're playing the good cop, bad cop routine. And you know, the good cop is this elderly silver-haired gentleman who keeps turning to the side and laughing. And the bad cop is the younger guy who I think he thought was making the best of his life, you know, and he you know, why did you speed up when you saw us? And I just resumed my speed and we thought you stole the vehicle. We thought you were headed for Mexico, you know. And finally, as they go to take the handcuffs off me, and they're giving me one last, you know, warning, like, why on earth would you be that disrespectful to the authority? And why on earth would you, you know, speed back up? And why were you carrying on this way? And the only thing I could really think to say was, it seemed like a good idea, and honestly, I just thought you were the Border Patrol.
That was Deborah Nelson, and you're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA. Anchorage.
During this hour, we hear Alaskans tell short, 7-minute stories about their lives. We'll hear stories that include persistence, insistence, and grabbing the bull by the horns.
And as usual, each storyteller has 7 minutes to share his or her story. You may have noticed the timer during that last story. At 5 minutes, the hosts of the live Arctic Entries show let storytellers know it's almost time to wrap things up. And then another timer sounds at 7 minutes to let the storytellers know it's time to make way for the next speaker.
Our next storyteller, Mike Gordon, grew up in Anchorage. Mike is well known for starting a local business on January 1st, 1970. The name of that business? They call it the world-famous Chilkoot Charlie's.
here's Mike Gordon to talk about growing up and taking risks in Anchorage.
The entrepreneur. You know, moving from Orange Grove, Mississippi, to Anchorage, Alaska in 1953 at the age of 10 was no small adventure. Like moving from the last holdout of the Confederacy to the last frontier. And as you might surmise, it was a military move. And my dad was, he was flown to Alaska, and my mother and my sister and I had to find our own way. Well, it was my idea that we take a Greyhound bus to see the country. And a week later, we got out of the bus in Seattle, and my mother and my sister wanted to kill me. So listen up, ladies. When you take the advice of the 10-year-old boy and things don't work out the way you had planned, you can't come back for retribution. You know, he's 10 years old. Keep that in mind. So anyway, we get to Seattle, and the thing I remember most about Seattle was the inoculations. Alaska was a territory, it was an overseas move, and we had to be inoculated against everything. Who would have guessed? You know, we had to get the polio boosters and everything imaginable, typhoid and tetanus and cholera and yellow fever and black death and God, you name it. It's like, then we get on a boat, the USS Funston, and it reminded me of getting on a that freighter in the black and white King Kong movie, going to the mysterious volcanic island. So I'm playing shuffleboard and watching whales. Sure enough, a week out of Seward, there's a rumor that goes around the ship that there's been a volcanic eruption, and Anchorage is another Pompeii. And I'm thinking, wow, how cool is that? Of course, my mother's having a fit because my dad's already there. So we get off the ship in Seward, and we get on the train. And I remember going through Portage Flats, looking out either side of the train at the herds of moose out there, ungulates. The biggest wild animal I'd seen was an opossum or a raccoon. And we get into Anchorage, and sure enough, it looked like they'd had a party for us the day before we got there, and the only thing left was the mess. There was volcanic ash over everything. And if you were too lazy to bend over and pick it up, you could buy it in little jars with labels on them in curio shops for years thereafter. Some enterprising person's reach for wealth, which is what this story is all about. So I find myself immediately in what appears to be a gold mine, Richardson Vista. Never thought about it that way, did you? Well, apartment after apartment after apartment, three-story buildings full of transient people, mostly civil service and military. And we've all thrown away perfectly good things when we moved, right? So just going through the dumpsters was like dredging for gold. We used to get furniture out of them and use them to decorate the pillboxes on the hillside that we fancied as forts. We found a couple of perfectly good corrugated metal sheets that we made into sleds and slid down the gravel hill down to Ship Creek. I look at that hill today and I think, wow, you know, it's a wonder I'm still here. So, my dad made a shoeshine box for me. And I went out to the 500-man barracks, and I'd cruise through the barracks, shooting the bull with the guys in shining shoes. How many of you would allow a 10-year-old son of yours to go to a 500-man barracks today and just roam around? You know, there are too many weirdos out there today. Where'd they all come from? Just the, maybe it's the fluoride in the water. Anyway, I'm out there shining shoes, having a ball, and I noticed that there are pop bottles laying all over the place. Well, pop bottles worth 10 cents at the Piggly Wiggly store. I'm learning that, you know, money's not all that hard to make. All you got to do is be aware, look around, put the pieces together. So I go over to Piggly Wiggly, and I borrow one of their shopping carts, and I start hauling pop bottles to them from the 500-man barracks. So I got a paper route, too, and it was a pretty big paper route, and I had a buddy that had one right next door, and we decided that we would not deliver the paper every other Friday. And we would take them instead to the gate where everybody was lined up in their cars to go home after work and sell them for 10 cents apiece. Of course, I would keep a couple aside in case somebody complained. And I'm not real proud of that, but, you know, guys got to experiment. So, anyway, I get this really good idea. It's the best idea of all. My sister was a freshman or a sophomore in high school at the time, and she was a knockout. She was like the living embodiment of pulchritude. And I had this picture of her, a school picture, wearing a tight sweater, showing off a couple of her more prominent attributes. And I took that picture out to the 500-man barracks. And the deal went like this. You subscribe to the Anchorage Times for 30 days, pay in advance, and I give you my sister's phone number. What a bonanza. Until the phone started ringing. 24 hours a day. My sister liked getting phone calls from guys, but not every Tom, Dick, and Harry on Elmendorf Air Force Base. And I remember the plaintive cry, "Daddy, make him stop!" And the subsequent licking I got. And it was the last licking I ever got from my dad. But because of that licking, that was the only really good idea I had, business idea, for the next 15 years. Choco Charlie's would just have to bide his time.
That was Mike Gordon live at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts in May 2014. You're listening to the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Jason Brandeis.
And I'm Rosie Robards. Our theme is I Got This. The Alaskan storytellers featured on this show volunteered to tell us about a time when they made a decision to just go for it.
Here's a story from Hans Arnett, who was also born and raised in Anchorage. You may remember his mom, Betty, who told a tragic yet humorous story about the Great Alaska Earthquake on an earlier Arctic Entries show. You can find that on our website, but for now, Hans has something a little bit lighter for us.
Several years ago, my friend Jill asked me to be in the bachelor auction that the American Diabetes Association puts on in the ballroom at the Sheraton Hotel, just down the street from here. Now, the way Jill explained it to me, all I had to do was put on a tuxedo, go up on stage, and then dance alone in front of 300 to 400 women, and then just stand there and wait for the bids to come rolling in. Now, I was recently divorced at the time, and to me, I thought that sounded like there was a lot of potential there. For soul-crushing public humiliation, I mean, what if nobody bid on you? Oh, God, just the thought. I politely declined. No, thank you. Actually, I think what I said was, no! But time passed. A year went by. Jill asked me again. I was feeling braver, and so this time I said yes. Now, every bachelor is responsible for putting together their own date package, and a date package is basically a date. You know, the women aren't actually buying the bachelors because, of course, that would be illegal. What they're buying is a date. And I knew that the better my date was, the more likely women would be to bid on me. And therefore, the less likely I would be to die of embarrassment. So I went all out. I had a train trip. I had a boat trip. I had a fishing charter. I had a trip to a salon. I had jewelry. I had all kinds of stuff. And on top of all of that, I would personally write three haikus, a especially for the successful bidder. And when the women down at the tuxedo rental shop, when they heard about that, they insisted that I wear this white silk scarf. I guess to give me that sensitive poet vibe. So the last thing is my dance. I got to admit, I am not much of a dancer. And so I went to the women that organized the event, and I asked them, I said, you know, when I get up on stage to dance, could I get the microphone for just a minute or two? I could pretend like I'm interesting or funny or something. And they're like, no, that never works. They were firm, no microphone. Well, their message was clear to me. My job was simply to shut up and shake it. So the night of the event arrives, and we 24 bachelors are paraded around the Howard Rock Ballroom to give the ladies a good look, I guess. And then we've got 30 minutes to mingle. Now, I'd written a bunch of haikus especially for this session. I had them printed up on business cards, and I'm passing them out as free samples. Eventually, we're shepherded backstage, and there the group of us sit around like war buddies waiting for our call to go up on stage and be auctioned off. And there's a video monitor, and we can see the other guys getting auctioned off. There's a pastor in his 60s that he goes for a couple of $1,000 to his girlfriend. And then there's a young guy, barely makes the minimum bid when he takes off his tuxedo jacket and flosses his crotch with it. Oh. Nobody liked that. Oh. Eventually, it's my turn. I'm bachelor number 17. I've been waiting for a couple of hours. There's a $1,000 minimum bid on me, and I go up on stage, and as I'm being introduced, I look out on this sea of women. 335 Anchorage women, and every single one of them is dressed to kill. It's an amazing sight. And the music starts, and I begin to dance. Now, being a gentleman of a certain age, shall we say, I learned my dance moves long ago during the height of the disco era, you know, awkward, rhythmically challenged moves that I'd honed at school dances in the Service High School cafeteria. Like my go-to move. The white guy overbite. And I danced. I got down off of the stage. I'm dancing between the tables. I'm spinning around. I gave it everything I had. I shook it. I just shut up and I shook it. And when the music ends, I'm standing there alone in front of the stage. And I'm greeted by this thundering and profound silence. As 335 women look on and do not bid. And I can feel my stomach starting to clench. I look out on this ocean of women's faces for one arm, just one arm to be raised, and there is nothing. And as I wait, I can feel time rushing past. Seasons are changing. Species are evolving as I wait and wait. At last, a bid from the big spenders table down front, and I can move again. I'm transformed. Unfortunately, I'm transformed into a panic. I go to the woman that's just bid on me. Her back is to me. She seems to be reading something, apparently oblivious to the bachelor auction that's going on around her. I don't understand. Didn't she just bid on me? It seems extremely important that I get her attention. I have an idea. Even though I'm in a panic state, I can still form simple, rudimentary thoughts on my own. And so I take off my scarf, and I gently drape it over her shoulder, and I slowly draw it back to me. Sexy move, I think. The woman turns around and glares at me. Oh, I don't know what to do. I just stand there like I've taken a punch. There's another bid. Oh, thank you, Lord. And I quickly move away from this woman whom I've apparently just angered with my scarf. I don't even remember how many bids there were. There was probably more than five, less than 10. Eventually, I'm sold for $1,600. And I walk the successful bidder over to the payment station. I walk her back to her table. We're having a very nice conversation. It's very pleasant. We get to her table. There's an empty seat next to hers. It feels like the natural thing to do, so I sit down next to her, and we have a nice conversation as we watch the last couple of bachelors get auctioned off. And at one point, she turns to me, and she asks, "Did they tell you to come sit with us?" I don't even know what to say to that. I just sit there silently, smiling like a moron. But inside, I'm shouting at the top of my lungs, "Will this night never end?" But it does. It does end. And that night, I have these vivid dreams of being pursued by large reptiles like Komodo dragons and things like that. It's just so weird. But time has passed, several years, and I've really got some distance between myself and the event now, and I really feel like I'm starting to get over it. And, you know, for instance, I no longer wake up screaming in the middle of the night. That's got to be good, right? And I've learned so many important lessons. The first and most important is this: you cannot die of embarrassment. You can't, or I wouldn't be here tonight telling you this story. And another very important lesson I learned while I was watching the last couple of bachelors get auctioned off, the last of whom went for more than $3,000. And this last lesson I'd like to share with you tonight in the form of a haiku that I've written. And it goes like this: what do women want? What sort of men will stir them? Oh, I see. Firemen.
You just heard a live recording from our May 2014 Arctic Entries event. That was Hans Arnett. Our theme for this show is I Got This.
Each month, the Arctic Entries Storyboard works with 7 Alaskans to share their stories. Anyone may volunteer to tell a story at the Arctic Entries live show. For more on that, visit arcticentries.com.
Now we'll hear from Bruce Hamler. He'll try to save face while telling us about an outdoor adventure he had in the 80s.
When I finally arrived at the Rabbit Lake checkpoint, I had skied over 70 miles and was about a third of the way through the 1987 Iditaski, which at that time was a 210-mile wilderness ski race. My race plan included an extended stop there to rest, rehydrate, and refuel. The temperature was minus 10. And I was well beyond cold, tired, and hungry. I needed to boil some water and cook food fast. Now, fortunately, race officials had cut a small hole about 50 yards away into Rabbit Lake so that we could get water and wouldn't have to melt snow. And I'm feeling pretty good about myself. I'm bundling up and getting my water containers and trotting down the trail, feeling pretty pleased with myself. I'm on schedule, having some fun now. And I get down to the water hole, and I, you know, put on these warm Polar Guard booties. They were great after skiing for 70 miles. And I had on down bibs and a down coat, and I was toasty, feeling pretty good. But when I got to that water hole and filled up those two big containers full of water, as I stood up, the whole shelf underneath me just collapsed and crumbled. And I do want to emphasize this part, because later there are a lot of questions. But I did not slip into the hole. And I did not fall into the hole. This icy vortex just swallowed me up. And suddenly, I'm, you know, treading bottomless ice water and screaming for my life. And I'm trying to push up on the closest, you know, ice and snow shelf, and it's just breaking away like styrofoam. And this happened not once, not twice, but three times. And I'm already exhausted. And my down clothing is starting to soak through to the bone. And, you know, obviously I'm getting really, really cold, but it's pulling me down like wet cement. And I'm thinking, this is it. This is the way I'm going to go. I'm going to die here. My screams have gone unanswered, and I'm just sinking into this icy abyss, thinking, this is it. I'm going to drown. And I'm thinking, this is a ski race. And it's in Alaska. It's February, early February. And in sub-zero temperatures, this is preposterous. I just can't believe that I'm drowning. And I remember, strangely, I remember this more than anything, there was no fear of death. You know, I was cold and tired anyway. It felt pretty good at this point. At that moment of truth, my greatest fear was of shame and embarrassment. I kept trying to think about how the officials were going to explain this to my friends and family. And I just resolved that I was not going to let myself die this way. I could not die in this ridiculous way. So slowly, very carefully, and I wasn't desperate now. I was kind of, this calm came over me. And this walrus-like seal crawl, I just sort of started creeping inch by inch up onto the snow and ice. And I got up there, and I was spread eagle on the snow and ice. I rolled over, and I'm on all fours, and I'm coughing and hacking up water and thanking God that I haven't drowned. And I try to get up. And I can't get up. I'm basically frozen to the surface. And I'm shivering uncontrollably. Shivering uncontrollably, and I can feel my clothing just freezing up, solid. And I realize if I don't get to that little wall tent with that little wood stove inside, I'm going to freeze to death now. And that's not so embarrassing, but it didn't feel nearly as good. But somehow I managed to stand up and break free from being frozen. And like some cross between the Michelin man, you know, all soaking wet, and the Tin Man without any oil, you know, I'm staggering back to that checkpoint and trying to run. And as I do, my clothing's just crackling and popping as I ran. And I burst through the door of the checkpoint, and I almost tackled that little wood stove. And I'm telling my chilling tale to the race official, and he's assuming I'm going to scratch. Calm down. We're going to take care of you. We'll get you warmed up. We'll get you out of here. Everything's going to be okay. We'll get you out of here on the next snow machine. And I said, whoa. I can stay here for 8 hours without being disqualified. I knew that was, a rule, and I was going to stay there, and I wanted some time to warm up and dry out and see if I might finish the race. So I did not scratch there, I decided I was going to give it some time before I made any hasty decisions. So I spent hours drying out my stuff and just trying to warm up and rehydrate, and I'm telling my story to the various racers as they come through the checkpoint. They came and went, and the one I remember most was Dick Griffith. He came through, and he already had his nose covered with prophylactic duct tape, and as I'm telling him my story, he's just scowling at me like I'm some young whippersnapper, which I was. But when I told him I planned to continue the race, he reached into his bag and pulled out a brand new pair of bright red, thick and dry wool socks. And he skied off down the trail towards Squintna. And by the time I left Rabbit Lake, he was hours and hours ahead of me. But I did finally escape from that Rabbit Lake checkpoint with some minutes to spare before that 8-hour time limit. My legs were still a little numb and wobbly, and it didn't take long before my brain started seeing things that weren't there. And it's definitely the toughest ski of my life. But after many prayers and hallucinations, I did make it to the Squintna checkpoint. And there, you could get a hot shower, which I did. You could get a spaghetti dinner, which I did. You could get a massage, which I did, and I think I did it twice. And for the first time since that ice water swim, I felt like maybe, just maybe, if I take it one checkpoint at a time, I can still finish this race. And on the way to Riversong, I skated past Dick Griffith once again. He was doing his old man shuffle, his classic shuffle. And I promised to give him his socks back. But in the Riversong Lodge, I'm lounging in there, warming up, you know, on the couch, just laying there. And he's in and out of there within minutes, just like every time. He's in and out of there, and he's down the trail, and I'm way, way behind him by the time I leave Riversong. But eventually, on the trail to Yenna Station, the next checkpoint, I passed him. And basically, we played tortoise and hare all the way down the Susitna River from checkpoint to checkpoint all the way to the Big Sioux. And my 20-something dream of finishing in the top 20 had been dashed and replaced by just this stubborn desire to finish. But now I wanted more. I wanted to beat Dick Griffith. Because way back then, I mean, he was old way back then. And I was young. And I wanted to give him those socks back. But it was not meant to be. The last thing I remember at the finish line was Dick Griffith pounding down this big burger, guzzling a beer. I basically collapsed and had to be poured into the back of a car where my sweetie could drive me to the nearest dock in the box. And later at that awards ceremony, they gave me a polar bear with an identity patch. A plaque that says, first original identity swimmer. And on one final note, they kept race statistics. In the post-race statistics, I spent over 30 hours. You know, Dick and I finished in over 60 hours, within a couple hours of each other, but over 60 hours. And I spent over 30 hours on the trail and over 30 hours in the checkpoints. Dick Griffith spent over 50 hours on the trail skiing and less than 10 in the checkpoints. The man continues to be an inspiration, and he's a living legend, and I still owe him a pair of red wool socks. Thank you.
That was Bruce Hamler live at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts in January 2014. Bruce has gone on to teach telemark and skate skiing, and he's been running his own paragliding school for 12 years. Well, we have one more story for you, but first, here's another song from Anchorage's SJ and Drums.
This song is usually real, real loud, but I couldn't leave it out. This song is about a man named Gene Moe. He was 68 years old, and he killed a bear with his bare hands. Killed a bear with just my knuckles and a knife. I was walking through the woods, he was coming for my life. My mama raised me strong, yeah, I showed her I was brave. I raised one fist to God, the other took him to his grave. shadow where you gotta go. I wanna prove I'm worth following home. So step in line, I swear that I'll atone. We're on our own, but you're not alone. Snow is piling up, I guess spring is coming on. I only write love songs when the timing is all wrong. Sun is shining bright, but I can't see it through my breath. Ask me to stay the night, 'cause I'm not quite finished yet. Shadow, where you gotta go? I wanna prove I'm worth following home. So step in line, I swear that I'll atone. We're on our own, but you're not alone. And in the forest I will find just what I need to change your mind. To a house of blood and bone, I'll take you home. I'll crawl to you on broken limbs just to find that shore again. I'll ride the crooked rooks that got you home. So step in line, I swear that I'll atone. We're on our own, but you're not alone. We're on our own, but you're not alone. We're on our own, but I won't leave you. So usually there's this huge drum solo right here. I want you guys to imagine it really hard. But instead, Gene Moe was 68 years old when he was in those woods. And that bear came up on him and all he had was a buck knife. And he thought, I could just stab this bear right in the mouth when he's coming at me and that'll be great. And he'll die and everything will be fine. But he missed that bear's mouth. And so they just went back and forth and back and forth, and the bear took chunks out of him, and he took chunks out of the bear, and eventually they were both so tired, and they were circling each other, and he raised his fist up to the heavens, and he said, "God is on my side, bear," and he punched the bear, and he broke that bear's neck. That bear died right in those woods, but he was all busted, and he had to crawl 2 miles through the woods with broken legs and broken arms, and finally made it to the beach just to tell his story. So Gene Moe deserves all the songs, and I'm going to keep singing them.
That was local band SJ and Drums on the Arctic Entries Radio Hour.
Our last story comes from none other than the guy described in that song.
Gene Moe?
Yeah, here he is, Gene Moe on the Arctic Entries Radio Hour. Oh, and there's some disagreement on whether he was 68 or 69 years old when this all happened, but let's just go with what Gene says.
Well, this is in 1999. I was just a kid then. I was 69. And I had a young boy with me, and he had got a deer before, and he wanted another deer, and it finds us on top of Raspberry Mountain Island. It's about 30 miles long, just north of the big island of Kodiak, and it's noontime, and I'd been hunting with him in the morning, and we haven't done anything. I've seen 4 or 5 deer, but the wind was squirreling, and we could not get close enough to get them, and we sat there, and we eat our lunch, and we're going to go on the other side where we can get out of the wind a little bit and to go there. And I noticed this young man had his ear lappers down. I said, please take them ear lappers off because you may hear a deer before you see him. Oh, I can hear good. Okay. So he goes on the ridge along a canyon, and I go down, and that wind was still doing this. And so we went a little bit farther, and there's a buck. So I thought, I better shoot him. We better have something today. So I shot him. I know he would come because I told him, if you hear me shoot, you come to me. If I hear you shoot, I'll come to you. Well, he didn't come, and I have my pack board on my back, and I had a piece of plastic there, and I always do this with a deer. Instead of dragging him a mile and a half, I butcher him off, take all the meat off the animal, put it in a game bag, put it in the pack, put it on my back, and I'm gone. And so I start butchering. I'm alone now. I've got to really hustle because we got to be at the shore down there between 4 and 4:30. It starts to get dark, and we got 10 miles to run with the boat. And so I've got everything done in 30 minutes. I look at it. Only thing I didn't have was the liver or the heart. And we always eat that liver and heart before our supper at night. We tell a story what we seen that day. And it's very interesting. We've got different hunters. And I've got the liver in this hand and the heart. I've got the knife in this hand. And around the corner, here comes the biggest growl you ever see. Here comes a bear just going like 40 miles an hour. I'm three steps from my gun, but I know I don't have time. I threw that stuff up on the plastic, and I took my knife, and I thought I had one chance to put that knife down the bear's throat. His mouth was open, he was slobbering, and he was yelling. And when he came, I made a gouge for him, but he turned his head, and I just missed alongside. Now, probably you could see this arm here. He grabbed my arm here, and if you talk about a pain, he pulled down to a bone and pulled my arm all the way down here with the meat. And I had my left arm, and I was going to put it in the bear's eye. Well, that bear's head is big. I came to his ear. And you see this bear went into that ear, and I went twisting this way and that way. And you know, that bear didn't like that. So then I had one other thought. I think my arm is gone. I don't want to look there if he took my arm or what. There's an awful pain there. But when we were young on a farm, we knew how to bulldog cattle. We would grab them by the horns, the bull, put the foot, and pen them down. Well, here's his long neck there, and I reached around, and I used to be pretty strong. I could lift 200 pounds over my head, and I've always poured concrete, and so I've never smoked, so I could run to 4,000 feet. And I reached around that bear on the neck, but that was a mistake. That bear made one little thing like this. I was 6 feet in the air, 10 feet where I landed. The bear went down and come around. This time he come, rah, rah, and I'm backing up to try to get to the gun. And I tripped over a root, and he's up there, and he kind of overshot me, and I got leather boots on. I brought him back to my chest, and I hit him right below the neck, and I ticked him off sideways, and I was up before the bear was up. And then that bear, he went down and he circled. Now, something about bear, if you look at us, probably every 10 of us, we'd have one left-handed. But a bear, I believe, is right pawed. Now, they'll jump in the water with both of them to catch a salmon, but you watch them when they're feeding. I've watched them for years. If they're raking in something with berries, he's got the left foot here, and he rakes everything in here. So I knew, well, I got to hurry. And he come at me, and I knew if he hits me, he'll take my head off. I back up, and the one claw cuts my ear in two here. And he then turns. I know I don't have chance now of that, so I wave my left leg when he comes around again, and he went for that leg. And I looked down at my arm, and there was the knife frozen into it on my knuckle, and I took that knife and I jammed it in his neck. I pulled it out, I jammed it again, I pulled it out, and I got in under his jaw, and I just dug. And he started pulling away, and when he pulled away, I hit him in the neck, and I must have hurt the neck bone, because his head turned like this, and he just flooded me with blood. I mean, just all over. And he came around, and he wanted a little bit more, but he was he was just as bad off as I was. And this time when he came, you see this finger here, it don't kind of work. I busted that knuckle there. But I hit him right in the jaw. He went down, and his head fell in the moss. He did not move. I went down. Actually, I think I broke his neck, really. And if you break a neck or shoot him in the brain or in the backbone, they're dead right there. But anyhow, I came back to the bear, and I did a dumb thing. I tried to drag back there and get back there. I went to kick the bear. And I don't understand that, but I do this. I looked up, and he says, "Lord, thank you. I laid down here, the bear laid there, and I remember telling the Lord, please take me home or give me strength to get to the ocean." That's my story.
That was Bear Attack Survivor Gene Moe live at the Alaska Center for the Performing Arts, and this has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour.
Thanks for tuning in. To hear these stories again or to share them with friends, visit arcticentries.com or alaskapublic.org. Our website also has information about upcoming themes, live shows, and details on how you, too, could tell a story.
We'd like to thank our storyboard, the storytellers for this show, and our musical guest, SJ and Drums. All of the proceeds from our shows are donated to a local social services nonprofit. Information about this is also at arcticentries.com. And a special thanks to our audio engineer from the Alaska Teen Media Institute, Kendall Stormo.
Thanks to Anchorage's own Super Saturated Sugar Strings for our theme music, and to the Alaska Humanities Forum for their support. This year, we're working with the Humanities Forum to hear stories about Anchorage's 100-year history. To nominate a storyteller for this, please connect with us through arcticentries.com. This has been the Arctic Entries Radio Hour on KSKA Anchorage. I'm Rosie Robards.
And I'm Jason Brandeis. Thanks for listening, and we look forward to hearing your stories.